Hello and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, a cybersecurity news and threat research podcast brought to you by the ReliaQuest threat research team. As always, my name is Chris and I will be your host today. And I'm joined this week by Caroline, who's on for the second week in a row. Can't get rid of you at the moment, Caroline. How's things?
Good. Things are good.
Fabulous. And we're also joined by George Paco, who's a member of the threat hunting team here at ReliaQuest. Welcome onto the podcast, George. Do you want to give the listeners a quick introduction to yourself and your role here at RQ?
Yes, my name is George. I work for ReliaQuest. I'm a threat hunter. And today we're going to discuss some interesting topics that would help you and your organization for security purposes.
Fabulous. That is what we aim to achieve here on Shadow Talk. So thank you very much for joining us, George. Always good to get new members, new blood onto the Shadow Talk family. So welcome. So we're starting with a topic we've actually touched upon in the past. So we're revisiting this one, and that's related to the SOC Ghoulish, aka Fake Updates Malware Distribution Framework, which, according to the blog which I'm reading, we actually released on this earlier in the year, has presented a gripping tale of intrigue and suspense for us here at ReliaQuest this year. Back in January, we identified and responded to a number of hands-on keyboard intrusions that were traced back to a SOC Ghoulish compromise. Our detections of SOC Ghoulish actually began in 2022, but that's continued into 2023. And as I just commented, we released a blog on this particular framework back in January. And I believe we also spoke at great length at this one on the podcast back in January as well. But given the threat is ongoing, we thought it'd be a good topic to revisit. So starting with you, George, given you're new around here, for listeners who perhaps didn't catch that episode, could you provide us with an overview of this malware distribution framework?
Yeah, no problem. So the SOC Ghoulish malware distribution network is opportunistic by nature. What that means is it uses a drive-by download system, which users reach out to a destination, which they're asked to download, usually updates, and then that download would basically drop malware in their endpoints. Given that this is part of the social engineering and the users are being tricked to download software that would suggest it's an update request, it's also called fake updates. A normal scenario would be a user browsing their normal articles or blogs. Sometimes those are compromised that would redirect the user somewhere and say, hey, your browser is out of date. You have to download this update for it. And they click it. And once that is downloaded and installed by the user, their host is compromised.
Good stuff. Yeah, you definitely don't want to be clicking on those particular updates in this case. What are the latest insights that we've observed with regards to SOC Ghoulish? Obviously, this is something that's been going on for quite a while, since back to 2022 at least. But what are the kind of latest insights that we've observed with regards to this type of malware distribution?
SOC Ghoulish is, like we were saying before, opportunistic by nature and a drive-by and download, which means they're very efficient in social engineering. Users that reach and basically download this new fake update will always think that is natural because it looks legitimate. So the initial vector is not going to change much. They're very successful with it. They're not going to mess with that. What they do is the second stage. The second stage is the malware delivery method, and usually that it changes. So we've seen some nuances and different approaches. In the historical versions, they would just drop PowerShell that would basically load a COBOL strike. But now they're using other methods like putting NetRat. NetRat is basically a malicious net support manager version. This is a legitimate software and tool which provides full control of a device. It's because it's supposed to be for administrators. It offers functionalities like real-time screening, monitoring, or monitoring of multiple devices. You can take control of the user's screens and their inputs. You can capture audio, video, or whatever they're seeing. So the malicious versions of this software are being sold or rented out in the underground crime marketplaces because it's a hot commodity. Given it gives similar functions such as Andromeda, Nanocore, Sirene Rat, Dark Comet, etc. The other good thing about this is that it's thoroughly documented. Given that this is legitimate software, the documentation exists for every aspect of it, and threat actors love things that are very well documented. So Ghoulish has also been observed dropping Blister Loader. This is another approach that they're doing nowadays, where Blister Loaded is loaded on the host. It's executed by RunDLL32. It unpacks code, so it basically has stored code in the resource section. And the defense evasion that it's doing so far from analysis is it waits about 10 minutes or so to avoid any sandboxing of it. And then after that, it decrypts the payload and drops either Cobalt Strike or Beatrat. So our intelligence team has been great at tracking SOC Ghoulish activity and capturing these deviations before we basically had a problem with them.
Good stuff. I do remember we were one of the first kind of security companies to actually report upon this. So really, really good to revisit this as well. But yeah, this is another example of how, you know, developers are just, you know, of SOC Ghoulish are staying agile, they're resourceful, moving at speed to adapt their TTPs, because, you know, defenders are switching onto this as a popular way of distributing malware. Speaking of defenders, what should we take away as a sensible measure to minimize the risk from SOC Ghoulish?
So given that it uses a social engineering techniques and it's basically luring users into downloading fake updates, user education is a priority. One way of minimizing the risk for your organization would be training. I would suggest the same phishing training that your organization would normally do could incorporate basically a fake SOC Ghoulish page. What that would do is when the user gets a phishing email from internal security and they click on it, it would send them to a fake update, they would download that, and they would get two trainings at the same time. I mean, this is one approach. The other approach would be to have a secure place for users to get their software updates, so they don't just update because the page says to update, and have a channel where they're safe. What I mean by that is like they can report social engineering attempts or social engineering attempts that they've fallen for, so that then security can go back and remediate whatever happened. For a defender's perspective, like let's say the internal security, I would say to not be too hung up on IOCs, because indicators change. Threat actors always set up new clusters of domains, IPs get assigned, and what is more important is the pattern of attack that SOC Ghoulish utilizes, and that is usually the same across the board, because they are, I said, very successful with that, with what they do, and they're not going to change it.
Good stuff. I think the thing that I took away from that was just you mentioning about security awareness and just having users have that culture of reporting suspicious items that land in their mailbox or other suspicious activity as well. But, you know, rather than just deleting it, actually report it to your IT team, because if it's landed in your mailbox, it's probably targeted to someone else in your organization as well, right? Or the risk of, you know, is wider to your organization too. So just making sure you have that culture of reporting suspicious activity, really. That's good. I mean, I remember when we covered SOC Ghoulish in the past, we talked about the type of activity that, you know, this leads to. And one of the things that we mentioned was ransomware. That's what we kind of observed, that, you know, SOC Ghoulish was likely being used by ransomware affiliates. A number of different operations kind of stood out. So I think Evil Core was the ransomware group that we associated it to. So quite a well-known ransomware outfit. While we're on the topic of ransomware, we'll move on to the second item of the day. A recent strain called Cactus has been identified and reported by security researchers, targeting susceptible VPN devices to gain initial access. So this one I'm going to target to you, Caroline. What's the story with this new type of malware?
Yeah, sure. So Cactus is a, as you said, a new strain of ransomware. This was recently discovered by Kroll to have been targeting large entities since about March of this year. The name Cactus seems to be self-imposed by the threat actors, as this name was included in the ransom note that was dropped. In all cases of the specific strain, and I think what might set it apart from others, is the initial access has been gained by the threat actor through vulnerable VPNs. By vulnerable, in the statement and release notes that Kroll put out, they don't make it explicitly known in the release document what exact vulnerabilities they're referring to. However, a number of other publications have made note of Fortinet, which many of us know over the past year, since at least the beginning of 2022, has had just a litany of critical and high severity CVEs announced.
I never would have guessed. Never would have guessed. That was the first one that came to my mind.
Yep. Also, Kroll mentions that this access is gained from a VPN server using a VPN service account. We can kind of connect this back to Fortinet again, just because we know that a combination of those CVEs together could lead to arbitrary code execution in the context of that affected VPN service account. Following this, the threat actor is known to establish an SSH backdoor for C2 communications via a scheduled task. And also, the goal of this ransomware is to first exfiltrate data to cloud storage. And this is going to be followed by a automated rollout of the encryptor within two stages of batch script deployed via PSExec. The encryptor binary itself that is extracted is kind of especially interesting, as it assigns a victim ID as the name of the executable. And this victim ID is going to be the same thing that they use for negotiation communications as well. And that victim ID is going to be a seemingly random string of four characters in four sets separated by dashes. And then also, as mentioned earlier, the ransom note is going to include that cactus.readme.txt as the name.
Excellent. So there's no cool reason why they're calling themselves Cactus. They just self-imposed that name onto themselves, did they?
Yes.
All right. Fabulous. Well, it is catchy, I suppose. Are there any similarities between Cactus and other variants of ransomware? So it appears to be quite a niche kind of threat, really, you know, kind of limited in the scale of devices it might be able to impact. Am I right in thinking that?
I'm not sure if I would say it has a limited amount of devices it can impact, as the ransomware itself can be deployed virtually throughout the Windows operating system. But as we said, the threat actors are depending on those vulnerable VPNs for initial access. With that being said, the high amount of critical or high severity Fortinet CVEs released in the past year, it seemed never ending, and it's just a real constant battle for organizations to keep up with patching. So that definitely does limit their scope, I guess. But as we know, organizations can be behind on patching, and it really just takes one to be open for them to be able to get in. With regards to other similarities or differences, basically, the attack chain and the tooling and techniques share a lot of similarities with what we have seen at ReliaQuest. For example, the remote access tools that this strain is seen using include SplashTop and AnyDesk. We've seen that pretty frequently prior to ransomware deployment. Also, for C2 communications, it uses Cobalt Strike, which is if not the most popular tool for threat actors to use for this purpose. And then also for exfiltration, we're using rclone, which is also seen pretty much across the board. It's been seen used by Conti, Lockbit, Black Hat, /LV. And then also there's a lot of really classic techniques. So they use lateral movement through RDP, PSExec usage, as we mentioned. There's operations to disable antivirus, and then also establishing persistence through scheduled tasks. And then one other big similarity that it shares to other strains is it also leverages the same script that's used by BlackBasta, known as TotalExec.ps1. And this is going to use that PSExec to automate the deployment of the encryptor. So I would say the initial access vector is what differentiates differentiates it the most. But once the attack chain starts kicking off after initial access, it's pretty cookie cutter stuff. Like, this is the classic recipe for what we see for a like precursors to ransomware and then after.
Excellent. I really like the analogy you used there, or the statement you used there of like, this is just cookie cutter for ransomware operation. I love that. I mean, these groups, they are what they are. They're monkey see, monkey do, right? They all kind of copy each other to a certain extent, but then they'll have their own little nuanced way of conducting operations, which, like you alluded to here, is the initial access mechanism of targeting like susceptible VPN devices.
Yep.
Go on, George. I see you've got your hand raised. Go for it.
No, what I wanted to say was that they share a lot of things. So we have to see it as the same way we are a community for the defense side, they're a community for the attack side. And if they're not selling to each other, they're likely sharing, saying, hey, look, I'll give you this, you give me that. Let's work together and do something together. I mean, Sogulish is an access broker, but it works with LogBit and Evil Corp. So, you know, anybody can work for anybody as long as money is involved.
Of course. They're equal opportunity criminals, right?
Yeah, basically.
Good stuff. I guess last question, kind of similar vein to what we mentioned with Sogulish, is ultimately what do owners of these VPN devices actually do need to do to protect themselves?
I would say the most important part is making sure that your VPN appliances are updated and patched to the most recent version. As we have kind of been stating over and over again, just the amount of CVEs that have been released for Fortinet over the past year has just been overwhelming almost. Also, I would say the next most important thing is defense in depth method of detection. As I said, a lot of these techniques are extremely cookie cutter and they're very easily detectable before impact. So making sure that you are detecting across all points of the kill chain, preferably earlier rather than later, all the way down towards things like exfil, lateral movement, things like that. And then also, just for being able to have that visibility into that initial access vector, we want to be making sure that we are logging our VPN.
Great stuff. You literally took the words out of my mouth there. I was just going to say visibility is key for these kind of things, right? It's understanding what you own and making a conscious decision to try and remediate vulnerabilities based on the risk. Mm-hmm. So obviously these high and critical severity VPN vulnerabilities would present, you know, they'd be in that little box, wouldn't they? These are the highest risk items you need to patch immediately. So it's understanding what you have, which is from my experience of kind of working a few different companies, that's always the one of the biggest problems. It's you have these mergers and acquisitions, you have these bolted on parts onto your network and people just don't understand it exists. And that's how these actors get in the first place. They exploit vulnerabilities on network black holes, basically, parts that, you know, defenders aren't aware of. So, yeah, great advice there. You know, vulnerability management just goes so far in improving your cyber resilience to so many of these different threats, including the likes of Cactus, and making sure you have the visibility of those devices so you can log it and detect it in good time.
Yeah, definitely. And just to back it up from our experience, more often than not, once we get to that lower end in the kill chain, it's always going to be that device that doesn't have an endpoint agent on it or doesn't have logging on this specific part. Like, that's how they were able to get that far in the first place. So making sure that visibility is there is extremely important.
There you go, folks. That's what you need to do. I will say as well, our int sum this week is going to be on the Cactus ransomware. So if you want to have a bit more of a deep dive on this particular threat, then definitely go check out the int sum. Excellent. Thank you, Caroline. So our last topic of the day is dedicated to a newly identified phishing as a service platform named Greatness that has seen a spike in activity as it targets organizations using Microsoft 365 in the United States, Canada, the UK, Australia and South Africa. The Microsoft 365 cloud-based productivity platform is used obviously by many organizations worldwide, making it very vulnerable to cyber criminals who attempt to steal data or credentials for use in network breaches. So this is a very commonly kind of targeted platform, as we all know. So George, how does phishing as a service in general operate for cyber criminals?
Yes, so the landscape has changed. Nowadays, everything is a commodity in the dark web, and phishing as a service is going to become a very hot commodity that threat actors are willing to pay for, because initial access is a very lucrative part of their business. So to understand this a little better, phishing as a service usually offers threat actors the tool set and infrastructure necessary for them to carry advanced attacks, but they don't necessarily need to know how to set it up themselves, right? So in the dark web world, this could be very beneficial to a lot of threat actors, but at the same time, it's honor among thieves. So basically, they could be paying for a service, and whoever is providing that service could also be stealing their harvest. But that's a different story. To understand a little more about how phishing as a service works and what it can provide, we can talk about Greatness, which is a new service in the block, basically. As a service, it requires very little from the user. All it needs is the content of the email and the targets. And once the targets and the content of the email is set up, it sends the victims a phishing message with a pre-crafted HTML attachment. So the HTML attachment in this case would be harvesting page, like it's going to load a page when the user clicks it. The attachment runs in JavaScript and collects data from the browser, and it utilizes this data to put the company logo and the email of the user, given that it already knows the email of the user. So when the user clicks on it, it looks like an official Microsoft 365 login page, but it's hosted locally, so it's not going anywhere. Now, the beauty of this HTML attachment is it's not separated, but it connects to Microsoft Office 365 and works as a proxy. And the reason why it does this is because it wants to communicate with Office 365 and the user at the same time and be the middleman. So let's say that the user has MFA, which is very good to have for security purposes. Well, if MFA is required, the Greatness attachment, which is now the loaded page, will prompt the user for MFA. Take this MFA, send it to Microsoft, authenticate as the user, and then steal the session cookies, which is basically an identifier of the user authenticating successfully on the destination, and send them through Telegram API to a chat box. Now, because the attackers will send phishing emails and they don't know when the user is going to access them, click them, etc., etc., this system is very intricate but also very adaptable, because it will message the threat actor basically that you have a new session cookie. And given that the session cookies expire, the threat actor will have to get on and utilize that access as fast as possible. So this is like a more complex or a little more advanced service that would give new threat actors everything they need to be successful in phishing. I mean, it's always social engineering. So like the content has to be good, the user has to click on it, and a lot of things have to go well, but it's way better than what they were used to offer before, which was less advanced. And the fact that it can also bypass MFA is very good, because that is a service that people will pay for.
Excellent. Yeah, these MFA bypass methods are really ingenious, many of them, aren't they? It's not a foolproof method. I mean, we always bang on about MFA. It's worth doing, of course it is, but there are kind of methods of stepping around that. Caroline, I know that last week when you're on the podcast, you discussed a different type of phishing as a service, Caffeine, I think it was called. What are there any notable differences between those two different types of Greatness and Caffeine?
Right now, I would say the biggest difference that I've observed is that Greatness is specifically targeted towards Microsoft 365 credentials, whereas it seems Caffeine is a bit more customizable with its payloads, though I would argue they're probably going to be targeting Microsoft 365 or those credentials. So even though that it's only targeting Microsoft 365 pages, This might allow greatness to be, maybe more advanced in the convincibility of those pages, since they're only targeting one portal. But yeah, right now I think that's the biggest difference that I've seen. I'm interested to see if any more information comes out about like the operations behind greatness, because I know last week we discussed like how advanced everything is behind Caffeine. They have a whole customer service operation, and it is almost like a real legit business. So I would imagine that it probably operates similarly, but I'd be interested to see if any information about that comes out.
Good stuff. We'll have to keep our eyes open then. Bit of a wider question for us all to finish the podcast on today, but what trends do you anticipate for phishing in general for the next 6 months? What kind of things do you see coming down the pipeline?
One thing that we've seen as a pattern is that threat actors will avoid redirecting the victims to external destinations. They've learned their lesson and they don't want to host any more websites, and they don't want to be flagged because their whole campaign will like basically go down very fast. Plus, most of those websites can be taken down. So what they're going to instead focus on is loading these phishing pages locally, mostly through attachments on the emails. And what we believe that is going to be a lot of utilization in the future will be API services and bots for automation. It is one of those trends where we have been observed. Caffeine uses it, Telegram uses it. There is a lot of systems that they're using nowadays to basically collect the data from the user's endpoint and send it straight out through API instead of going through browsing or, you know, redirects and stuff like that. And they do that to avoid any kind of firewall, you know, being blocked and detected. The one way that I've seen threat actors circumvent the domain issue or the hosting issue is use Web 3.0 and peer-to-peer systems like IPFS. IPFS is basically Interplanetary File Service. It's a peer-to-peer system. You could imagine it like BitTorrent, where you can host things on it, and as long as one of the nodes has the data, it cannot be taken down. Now, of course, this is known, and there's a lot of vendors that have security detections for it, and they block those before you even receive the email. So what ReliaQuest has noticed lately as a trend is they're utilizing Google Translate and IPFS together. So what they do is Google Translate has this feature where you can have a URL and have translate.google in the URL path too. And when you click the URL, Google will basically reconfigure the URL and start translating the page to whatever language you want. Now, they're using this to change the pattern so the detection from the vendors does not flag it and it goes through to the user. The user clicks on it and they're redirected to a Google page. It's a Google Translate page. So they trust Google and then they go like, okay, so this must be, you know, a normal page. And then it goes from there. So the future of phishing, it's going to be more sophisticated. They're going to utilize more exploitable systems or abuse systems that already are normal. They will use more automation and likely more peer-to-peer hosting, given that it's resilient and can be used across the board without ever being taken down. Or at least that's what we foresee.
That's super interesting. Really, really interesting. I remember Corey was on the channel talking about API keys and Telegram bots, I think, on this same note. That's really interesting. Anything you want to add on top of that one, Caroline?
Yeah, I guess I will just plug what we, I guess, don't really see changing and continuing to be observed is just the sophistication of these attacks. These phishing campaigns are always going to be changing. So it's very important for defenders to keep up on what different techniques that these attackers are using to trick users. Also, I would say that I would expect these phishing as a services platforms to continue to rise in popularity just because of the extremely low barrier to entry that they present for attackers. The phishing is extremely successful for attackers, and why fix what's not broken. And I really just can see it continuing to operate in that way.
Good stuff. Yeah, why fix it? Indeed. Yeah, if it's working for you, just keep doing it, right? Yeah, that's a really good point to end on there. Excellent stuff. Thanks very much, guys. I'll just end the podcast by mentioning the blog we have going out this week. That's funny enough, on API keys, essentially outlining the risks associated with this important piece of technology and what sensible steps you can really take to remediate the risks if you do happen to lose an API key or otherwise, you know, operating them in an insecure manner. That's it for today. Thank you very much to Caroline and George. Thanks very much, guys.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thanks to all of our listeners. Stay safe and we'll see you next week.